Climb into the cockpit with pilot and Wing Square's Chief Legal Officer, Tim Perilla, as he invites legal leaders aboard to share advice that will help you navigate even the most turbulent times of in-house counsel work. We'll cover a range of topics from data privacy to legal team structure to public company transactions and beyond. You don't want to miss this series. Fasten your seatbelt and prepare for takeoff. You're listening to Cockpit Counsel.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Cockpit Counsel. My name's Tim. I'm the Chief Legal Officer at Link Squares. And if you like our show, give us a like, subscribe on all the socials, and let's get started. So, as always, with me is Alyssa Verzino, our producer, and Greg Anderson here today from EW Scripps. Welcome.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for being on the show.
Happy to be here.
So we start every show the same way, the same question. What is your pre-flight ritual? Like, just literally pre-flight, like not a figurative.
Well, I'm super hardcore ADD, so most of the time it involves driving to the airport as quickly as possible and running through the airport to catch the plane because I'm running late. Nice. But my favorite. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just gonna say you're probably giving like a whole bunch of people anxiety.
It's
can tell David over there is like.
I've tried hard over the years to fix it, but it's just one of those things. I'm always running late. But probably my favorite is when I'm traveling with my family, which is my favorite way to travel. My wife and I, as we're taking off, we usually, right as the wheels go up, we kind of hold hands real fast for a second. And just,
oh, that's,
and that's
cool.
Something we started a long time ago, and we always do it. So that's my favorite.
That's awesome. Very cool. So let's talk a little bit about your career.
Mm-hmm.
Just all the way through. So you've been at EW Scripps for a while now.
Right? Yeah, about a little over 4 years.
Yeah. Okay. So like, what brought you there? And just maybe talk about your entire career path. As much as you want to share.
Sure.
I guess.
I ended up at Scripps because I was working with the CISO, Mike Kelly, outside of both. We were both involved in the cloud security organization. So we met through a couple of panels that we worked on and that type of thing. And the chief privacy officer role came available, and Mike reached out and asked me if I'd be interested. Said, I'm always interested. And the next thing I knew, I had an offer and started with Scripps. So it was really, the job is chief privacy officer, but I've always been a very security oriented attorney. And and certainly when I, in the privacy role, very close to the security organization. So that was the inroad to Scripps and how I got started there.
Nice. Mm-hmm. And where were you before?
So before I was at Lexmark International. So Lexmark, printer company, I think main competitors like HP and Xerox. Lexmark is 10,000 employees in like 50 countries around the world. And I'd been there for quite a long time, for about almost 15 years before leaving to go to Scripps.
Okay.
So it's been a good part of my career at Lexmark.
Did you just sort of grab privacy in recent years, like the recent years leading up to the move to Scripps, or was that something that like data security privacy has been your thing for your whole career?
So I've been a technology lawyer my entire career, always technology focused, and at Lexmark was sort of an organic progression into privacy when GDPR came around. We needed somebody to take on the role of the first data protection officer. And for many years, I actually started at Lexmark in a finance role and did that for a couple of years. And then an opportunity because of the JD and the legal background to take on one of the attorney roles as a customer facing attorney, one of the deal guys. Mm-hmm. And because of Lexmark being a technology company, both hardware and services, for highly regulated customers, there was always a technology component. There was always a compliance component, and more and more privacy and security became conversations that we had with all of our customers very early on. So when our CIO was looking for somebody to take over the privacy job, it was kind of a natural fit. So I moved over there and moved out of the still customer facing, but moved out of being embedded with sales to the IT, working directly for the CIO, with the CISO and the CIO.
That's very cool. And did you work at a firm beforehand or?
No, yes and no. So like we all did, you know, one summer in law school and then after my third year of law school, I actually went to France and got a French law degree. So
Cool.
I was in Lyon, France, and part of that year.
Lyon's beautiful.
It's great.
Yeah, it's really nice.
It's not as well known as it should be, but it is a wonderful city. But so part of that year I was taking classes and then also working for a firm over there at the same time. So my only time, you know, inside of a firm was there was my summer internship while in law school, and then when I was in France.
No kidding. And did you have a finance undergrad degree?
No. Okay. I learned all of that stuff the hard way.
Okay.
And one of my soapboxes that I will talk to any students that are trying to, you know, talking about going to law school.
Yeah.
Tell everybody, please take that extra year, go do the joint JD MBA, because you're going to have to learn it some way. And it's much easier to do it than, I know, another year of school at that point in your life sounds like a horrible idea. But
yeah,
I really wish I had done it. And no, I got a lot of books and had to learn it the hard way.
Yeah, those are the lessons that you learn on the job that you wish you had known.
You didn't have
to learn that way.
That's right. I mean, the running joke is we all went to law school because we can't do math, right? But at some point or another, you're going to have to figure it out.
Yeah, exactly. And usually it's not particularly complex math either.
No.
You know, we lawyers struggle with that anyway.
That's right.
So, transitioning from the role in finance to a legal role, how did you find that?
Because of what I'd been doing previously, moving into the legal role, which was, you know, mainly a transactional, you know, I was customer facing, negotiating complex outsourcing agreements. So the transition was actually pretty smooth. But made more so, I think, because of in the finance role, it was also sales related. So putting together business cases for the deals that we were doing.
Oh, that's
which,
cool.
Which really, doing that for the first couple of years at Lexmark really gave me an insight to the business.
Yeah.
And really got to learn, you know, what the puts and the takes were of the financial models that I was building. So then taking that and moving into the role where it's actually negotiating the deals, you understand, you know, the puts and the takes. What are the points that are important, and where can you give, and what do you have to double down on?
Yeah, absolutely. That's insanely valuable to have that background and then come in and start actually reviewing the contracts. And I'm sure it gave you instant credibility with the sales folks that you're working with too.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly helpful, right? So coming in as, moving from the role where I was building out a financial model for them to let them understand, you know, what the margins were going to be, what the revenue was going to look like, and then translating that into being their guy going into these negotiations, trying to get the deal done. Very helpful to be able to speak intelligently to what the financials of the deal were and know where they had room to move.
Yeah, absolutely. And how long? And I know I'm kind of jumping around all over the place here, but how long were you like not practicing?
I feel like I was always sort of practicing, right?
Sure. So you can never turn off the switch.
That's right. So after I went to University of Georgia for law school, and after leaving Athens and going to France for the year and coming back, I actually ended up in the wireless communications industry. So building out cell phone towers, basically.
Okay.
I worked for a company called American Tower. Well,
yeah.
I worked for a company that became American Tower, another Boston-based company.
Yeah.
So I ended up at that job through kind of a strange path, but they were looking for somebody with either a legal or a real estate background, because we were doing zoning permits and building permits and finding sites to put up towers and rooftop spaces.
Yeah.
So, that job, the legal background ended up, putting in applications for zoning and building permits, and then arguing them in front of zoning commissions, neighborhood associations, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Was quasi legal, and went from that to doing more legal work for the company, both in Atlanta and in Seattle for a couple of years. And then from people I met, I ended up working abroad for a bunch of years. So was in Switzerland for two, Montreal for two, Sweden for two, and then finally back to the States, where I started working for Lexmark. So
that's pretty cool.
So I was, uh, I, was never quote unquote the lawyer in those jobs, but was absolutely using the legal background and the degree.
Yeah, you can't not.
Right.
Right. Yep. It's impossible to just ignore that.
That's right.
Right.
Yep.
And I'm sure people, it gives the other business folks a certain degree of comfort, even if you're not like per se acting in the capacity as legal counsel. Yes. It's just like, all right, Greg's got a legal background.
Right.
We know we're going to be within some meets and bounds here.
That's right. I mean, it really, you end up multitasking, right? So
yeah.
Doing a business role, but with the legal credibility and skills, you're able to, I think, bring more to the table than somebody that didn't have that background.
Yeah.
And it, for me, negotiating leases, working through, and even really, in some cases, doing double duty, right?
Yeah.
We don't have to go spend money on outside counsel for that. I've got it. Like, I can handle this, right?
Yeah.
We don't need to spend the money. So it's really being that value add and bringing more to the table that makes you, I think, a valuable asset.
Yeah, absolutely. And just side note, what part of Switzerland were you in?
So all over the country, but okay. I was living first outside of Zurich and then in Zurich. So I was
okay.
in the German part.
Yeah.
French speaker ended up in the German part of
right.
Switzerland.
Like, why can't this be Geneva?
Yeah, but it worked. Yeah. I mean, it worked out because I got to learn some German that way. But
yeah.
So we had offices in both Zurich and Geneva. And then ironically, Lexmark's European headquarters ended up being in Geneva as well. So
yeah,
got to go back over for Lexmark as well.
Geneva's a very cool town. Zurich's a cool town too. Mm-hmm. I've spent a little bit of time in. So I've got a group of friends. We go to Oktoberfest every year.
No, oh, nice.
And we always do a side trip.
Okay.
And we've done like, all right, let's go to Austria
mm-hmm.
for a couple of days. And then kind of we all hop in a van
yeah.
and, you know,
hopefully
travel together.
Hopefully before Oktoberfest.
Yeah, exactly. And then we end in Munich,
okay.
spend 2-3 days at the fest, and then we all fly yeah. back. It's direct flights.
Yeah. A van after Oktoberfest sounds like a really bad idea. So
no.
You're doing that in the right order.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, listen, it's always a little bit of a bad idea, but it's fun,
yeah,
right?
Definitely.
You still have the energy at the beginning of the
yep.
trip. But one year we did Switzerland, which was
okay.
great. And we really wanted to, so we started in Geneva, but we really wanted to see Montreux. So we ended up doing
cool.
Doing the drive to Montreux and, you know, taking the selfies in front of the Freddie Mercury
sure.
statue
yep.
and all that stuff.
Awesome.
So very cool, playing Smoke on the Water the whole time.
There we go.
You know.
Fantastic.
Anyway, okay. I completely forget what we were talking about. Oh, we were talking
yep.
about lawyers. That's right.
Right.
So now you're the chief privacy officer.
Mm-hmm.
How are you still involved on a regular basis in like a lot of the transactional side of the house, or is it like strict sort of privacy counsel stuff?
No, so it's a little bit of everything. Yeah, so I mean the title and the day job is chief privacy officer, but because of the technology background, I brought a skill set to Scripps we had other lawyers that were doing some of it, but I just more a deeper background in technology than the other folks in the legal department. So I end up doing quite a bit with inbound and outbound contracts. And I think it goes hand in hand with privacy because you have to be looking at these contracts in order to make sure you've got the right language anytime data is involved or any kind of connection to our networks. And I mean, anymore, that's everything almost.
Right.
So again, back to being that value add and bringing more to the table than just, oh, I'm only going to do this one little narrow thing. Nothing in the world I hate more than over-lawyering anything. So
yes.
Instead of saying, okay, hey, you do your part and then I'll do my part and we'll hand it on to somebody else. If I'm going to look at the contract, I'm going to look at the contract,
yeah.
right? I also believe that if you are only looking at one little section, you're not doing your job. I don't see how anybody
yeah.
looks at, you know, one section of a contract out of context without understanding the deal.
Yeah.
Different conversation perhaps, but
yeah.
So I try to look at pretty much anything that has tech involved comes across my desk in one way, shape or form. So it is it's part of what I think makes a good privacy program, but that's where, you know, the contracts become a huge part of the job.
Yeah, absolutely. So how big is your team?
So the legal department is, I think it's 12 lawyers now.
Okay.
It's been expanding. So sure. Scripps is 100, I'm going to get in trouble. It's a 140-year-old company.
Okay.
Started off by a guy named E.W. Scripps selling newspapers on the side of the road for 10 cents a pop.
That's awesome.
And the company has, you know, expanded and contracted over the years, going from newspapers to radio, radio to TV, slight detour into podcasting for a while. And we got out of that business a few years ago before we went through an acquisition of Ion. And at about the same time that happened, the legal department started expanding. And so when I say we have 12, I might be off by one or two, but I think that's the right number.
Yeah. And Ion, is that the television network?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very cool. Mm-hmm. Very cool. So let's talk, maybe we'll just talk a little bit and kind of shifting.
Sure.
The connected company,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Everything's talking to everything else.
Yeah.
Can you walk through a little bit your tech stack, how you're integrating everything?
Yeah. The idea of the connected company is one that to me is, there's progress has been made, but I've yet to meet anybody where I think the idea has really been embraced successfully to the extent that it can.
Right.
You still have silos across organizations where either divisionally people aren't talking to each other or systematically things aren't talking to each other.
Right.
And in my perfect world, you bridge all of that. So there are these links, whether it's API calls between software tools or, you know, divisionally, you're able to look at a tech stack sort of from a 50,000 foot level.
Right.
Trying to stick with the theme.
So
you've got like a holistic view of what's going on. Right. And
yeah.
You know, again, progress has been made, you know, link squares, other tools, API calls between, being able to pull things in, but it's still not there to the extent it can be. And I think that's sort of the perfect world where you have like this holistic view of how data and information is moving throughout the company. And the more fluid you can make that, the more beneficial it is to the business and pickups in running the business.
Yeah, what I've found that a lot of folks struggle with, we struggle with here, and every company I've ever been a part of struggles with it to a certain extent, is you have a lot of data and you're able to move it, but it's really hard to contextualize it at a particular point along this like data highway that you have within the organization.
Yep.
What if any have you found in terms of like tips to try to bring that into a little bit more lens of clarity?
So I mean, we're still on that journey. I could probably better talk about my vision than what we've done so far.
Yeah.
And and that's really where the conversation with Link Square started, and having a next generation contract repository came into play. Because, and again, it may be somewhat myopic, but I mean, contracts is what I know and what I love.
Yep.
And I think looking at contracts really can explain what's going on in a business, right? You can look at the numbers all day long, that's great, but the numbers don't tell you necessarily, you know, who you're doing business with or what kind of business you're doing.
Right.
If you can have that sort of extrapolated view of your contracts, contextualized, as you put it, and we all know that trying to explain to somebody in the business what that contract says, God love them, they never read them, right? Like,
right.
You know, we're the only ones that actually sit down and read them, like, you know, and they,
yeah.
I don't know how many times it's happened to you, but you get handed an agreement and they said, this is an agreement to do X. And then you read it and it's like, yeah, except it's for Y, right? Or it's completely not, it doesn't say what you think it says, or it says what you think it says and then some stuff, right?
Right. But it's totally market.
Oh yeah, right. Oh, exactly. Right. No,
it's
no,
completely it's, market.
Right. And they don't make any changes.
Right.
They don't, you know, it's non-negotiable.
That's right.
One of my faves. But the ability to lift that information outside of the four corners of that document and being able to present that or explain it to the business, and whether it's the contracts or the numbers or you know, your personnel information, you know, what have you, but then to bring all of that together so you have this sort of holistic view of the business, I think is sort of the ultimate goal. And the more you can have systems that will integrate and talk to each other, and again, like extrapolate that information to a point where you can, you know, whether you dashboard it or, you know, what kind of report, you know, report on it, but to be able to make it easily consumable to various audiences is, I think, what the ultimate goal is, and which would be really, really cool.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, I think it's really important to identify the right audience too. Mm-hmm. Like I think about it in a handful of different ways, but the best example that I've found as far as like the legal team is concerned and being able to put that data into context is your CEO says he wants to sell a product abroad, mm-hmm. right? All right. Lawyers got to do all sorts of work, right? You're taking your widget, you're selling it in some other country, you know, Spain, France, whatever.
Right.
You have products liability, you have disclosures, you have IP issues potentially that you have to deal with mm-hmm. that maybe domestically you wouldn't need to.
Language.
Import, export, yeah. Language, exactly, all sorts of different things. And maybe it takes the legal team 90 hours to get all of that stuff in order. Maybe it's 200 hours, who right. cares? What the CEO cares about is that from the time that he walks out of the meeting where he said, I want this product on the shelves, that it's 3 months before it's actually on the shelves,
right.
or 6 months or 12 months or whatever right. it is. And that's all about context.
Yep.
It's like, okay, well, what can I, you know, what can I actually bring and measure? And when you think about it with your contracts alone, think about your sales cycle,
mm-hmm.
right? And what can the data tell you about your sales cycle?
Yep.
Just based on what lawyers are doing.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I know with, you know, with our team internally here, like obviously the contracts that we see are a good leading indicator for what the, you know, week, month, quarter end is going to look like.
Sure.
And I regularly surface that and be like, listen, we're seeing X percent delta over last quarter. And so what's going on? What are we expecting? Is, mm-hmm. you know, is this an anomaly? Is there something that happened in the business? Like, is this a result of, you know, a massively well-executed marketing campaign and we now have to like staff for this volume going forward,
right?
Right? Like all of that sort of stuff. But bringing that context is just so critical.
And the, again, I mean, as always, the more contracts, the more data you have, the better you can be. So, I mean, things that seem like minutia, payment terms, SLAs, SLA yeah. credits, right? I mean, that's where I think a well-functioning contract team isn't just about moving the document through the process, but then it's the after the signature managing and the operational management of those agreements, right? Where
that's
you can
right.
really bring value. So it starts being another barometer for the business that outside of having a tool that allows you to do that, you're blind to.
Yeah.
So that's I get jazzed thinking about that kind of thing. And I think it's possible, but I've yet to see anybody that's doing it super well.
Right, right. It's that's going to lead into what I was going to ask you about next is legal is often viewed as a cost center
mm-hmm.
because a lot of times it is, a lot of legal teams view themselves as just moving the documents along
right.
or just, you know, managing it when things go wrong,
yep.
Post-signature, things like that.
Yep.
But, you know, you and I both have a very different view on what the legal team can bring if it's functioning well. How do you make sure that the legal team is not just a cost center?
Well, I don't own the legal team at Scripps, but
right.
I'm an army of one in that regard. But
right.
But what I think is important is, or what drives me crazy are the ivory tower lawyers, right?
Yeah.
Now they're fun to negotiate against because they
sure.
don't understand the business, and sometimes you can do some fun stuff with that.
Yep.
If you know, you've got an attorney that will only look at the limitation of liability and doesn't want to sully their hands with the commercials, that's
right.
makes for a fun negotiation sometimes. But
yes.
I think it's sort of what we talked about earlier, and it's being that value add, it's gaining the trust of the business that you're their person, you're on their side, you're there to achieve what they're setting out to do, and that you're on the same team.
Yeah.
So even when you have to have sometimes those tougher conversations, nobody wants to, you shouldn't want to be the department of no.
Yeah.
You should, I always say, I'm not going to tell you we're not going to run with scissors because I want to run with scissors too.
Yeah.
But we're going to talk about maybe a safer way to run with the scissors, right, or the right way to run with the scissors.
Right.
The other one, again, let's go jump out of a plane, but I'm here to help pack your parachute.
Right.
So I think it's gaining that level of trust and being that value add and understanding. I learned early on in my career that it's important to have your line of sight to the customer, right? So it's, what am I doing today? What am I doing every time I open up the laptop to benefit the customer? So it's that's even in the legal department, it's that line of sight to the customer, be it your internal customer or your external customer.
Absolutely.
Makes a lot of sense. And so to be a connected company, you also have to be connected to other teams through relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Would love to hear how you approach breaking down silos through different relationships that you build across the organization.
It takes time.
Yeah.
I guess to continue the analogy, it's coming down out of that ivory tower, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so go to all the meetings. I think you see too many people in the legal department that don't feel a part of the business and then don't make an effort to become a part of the business. Mm-hmm. And very rarely are people going to reach out and invite you, right? Mm-hmm. So you have to find a way to get yourself invited or invite yourself or say, hey, can I come, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm really interested in what the goals are. I'm really interested in what the business is trying to do. So can I come to that stand-up meeting? Can I come to your Monday mornings? Can I come to whatever it is? So
mm-hmm.
Whether it's you're supporting the business or your privacy, I go to all of the IT all hands meetings every month. I go to every team's stand-up meetings that I can,
mm-hmm.
Understand what the product roadmap is, because that way you understand what people are tasked with, what their goals are, what they're out to achieve. And the more you can align yourself with that,
mm-hmm.
then you become part of the team and somebody that they can rely on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you have any tips for somebody that might be earlier in their career and they're looking cross-functionally, trying to identify, like, where can I add value?
Yeah, I ask a lot of questions.
Mm-hmm.
Be curious. Don't, your job may be being the lawyer,
mm-hmm.
but that, one of the fun things about being in-house is that you get to go deeper, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't spend a lot of time working for a firm, but I've spent a lot of time managing outside counsel.
Yep.
And I'm not sure I would have been able to do that job full time, right? Because you don't get to go deep. You're doing a task for that person and you're moving on to the next client. The fun thing about being in-house is you really get to go and understand what the business is doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think my tip to somebody that's starting out is just be curious. Know everything about the business that you can, and maybe even better than the people that you're helping.
Mm-hmm. That's great advice. And you also spoke about building trust.
Mm-hmm.
So do you have any advice on building trust with other teams or building a team where there's trust as a foundation?
With other functions, I think what's served me well is being reliable, right?
Mm-hmm.
So show up when you say you're going to show up, do what you say you're going to do, and don't let them down.
Mm-hmm.
So just making sure that they know that if they hand something off to you, that you're going to come through for them. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it might not be the answer that they wanted, but you are going to come back around. So just try to keep all the balls in the air. And I think the same thing with building a team, which is...
Mm-hmm.
Be transparent, be truthful, be able to have the difficult conversations if you need to,
mm-hmm.
but also that you will have your team's back and be on their side.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the sort of the fundamentals of any relationship, but that's the way I've built teams in the past is answer any question, and if I don't know the answer, I'll go find it out, whether it's a good answer or a bad answer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's great. Awesome. Well, we end every episode with some rapid fire questions.
Okay.
So if you're ready, what is your hot take on working in-house?
At the right time in the right place, it's the best job there is.
Nice. What's your number one tip for building cross-functional relationships?
Yeah, be curious. Ask a lot of questions.
Yeah, awesome. What is the best leadership advice that you have ever given or received?
Two things, really. One is lift your people up. Put your people ahead of yourself always. And always be willing to do every job. There's no job that's too beneath you at any
mm-hmm.
point. You should always be ready to be shoulder to shoulder with people and do whatever you might ask them to do.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
And what's a charity or a cause that's close to your heart that our listeners should check out?
So I'd say the The National Volunteer Fire Council. So there's a large, really large portion of firefighters, EMTs out there that are volunteer. So 65 to 70%, I think, of all firefighters in the US are volunteer.
Yep.
And so some of them may be working at paid stations as well, but there's a lot of people out there putting their lives on the line to help the community. And so the NVFC supports those folks. So either NVFC or just your local fire department.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Sure. This was a great conversation, and we're going to have to do this again.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. Appreciate it.
A lot of fun. Sure.
All right.
Thanks.
Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next time.